Right, my voice is a bit croaky, so hopefully you can all hear me properly. So, Ship versus Ulrich. Well, let's look at the contestants. We'll start with the ship. Try and start with the ship. Okay, things are a bit slow. Right. Well, that's a ship. It's known as the Big Orange, or to give it its full name, Big Orange 18. As you can see, it's orange, but it isn't anymore, but we'll get to that later. And I suppose by some ship standards it's big, but not compared to an oil tanker. It's a slightly unusual vessel. It spends its life mostly in the North Sea, pumping stuff down oil wells. Normally, of course, things come up out of oil wells. But oil can coat the side of the oil well, it can all get a bit sticky and grimy, and they need a bit of a clean occasionally. So it's what's known as a well stimulation vessel. It can pump solvents and all sorts of other weird chemicals down the pipes to try and clean things out, including concentrated hydrochloric acid, of which it can contain about 800 cubic metres of hydrochloric acid can be on board, which is rather a lot. When I'm on board work-wise doing maintenance, I'm on the deck immediately below these tanks, so I rather hope they never leak. As I said, it's not orange anymore. So it's now blue. Corporate livery changed, therefore the colour of the ship changed. But they didn't change the name of the ship. Apart from the else, it's generally considered in marine circles to be bad luck to change the name of a ship, although it happens actually quite a lot. You'll also notice between these two photos that the rear deck has got rather more stuff on it than it did in the previous one. If I just go back to that one, you see the rear deck, it's got a couple of containers on it, but it's pretty open. Whereas now there's all sorts of bits sticking out. The reason for that is the bit immediately behind where the crane is, you'll see a big white sort of pyramid-shaped lump. There's another one on the other side. That's one of two silos for large amounts of sand. And that's because the other thing they fitted on the back of it are three what's known as catfracks. They're big diesel-powered, high-pressure pumps powered by Caterpillar diesels, and they're used for fracking, hence the name catfrack. They weren't part of the original fit, but they were added quite soon afterwards. This ship's been doing fracking in the North Sea for quite a while without any problem. But of course, unlike on land fracking, which is also in a different type of rock, if there's a bit of a tremor in the ground and an oil rig, no one really cares because they'll probably know all about it because it's going on in their own rig. But when plates start rattling in people's living rooms, they start to complain a bit. So fracking's not quite as new as people might actually believe. But it's not the only thing it does. It can also, as I mentioned, the hydrochloric acid, it can pump down oil wells, solvents, and quite a few other things. So, if you're hooked up to an oil rig, this is an example of hose reels hooked up to the oil rig, obviously in very close proximity, and it's extremely important that you don't crash into the oil platform. Therefore, it's got a slightly different propulsion system to normal ships, but it's actually fairly standard for oil industry supply vessels. So instead of just a propeller or two out the back and rudders, up the back it's got what's known as azimuth thrusters, or sometimes called azipods. These can swivel through 360 degrees and therefore propel the back of the ship in any direction you like. There's also two powerful thrusters in the bow to allow that to be moved sideways as well. The ship uses this when it's hooked up to the rig in combination with a dynamic positioning system, which is a computer system that it's got a lot of inputs that tell it exactly where the ship is and what its orientation is, and make sure it stays exactly where it's supposed to be. Some of the inputs from that are obviously GPS these days. It's also got a couple of weights that can lower over the side, taut wires that rest on the seabed, and it can use those to work out where it is. And other inputs include wind speed measurement devices, so if there's a sudden gust of wind, it calculates what effect that's going to have on the ship, and start spinning up the propulsion system to compensate for that before the ship even moves. And of course, this level of maneuverability means that this vessel, in common with other similar offshore supply vessels, etc., it can quite happily spin on its own axis. They don't normally have a requirement for that, but when we go out doing testing occasionally, they do it just to test things. So, that's the ship. You'll know more about that later. But next, the oil rig. Well, not just any old oil rig. I'll use the term oil rig and oil platform interchangeably here, as people often do. The oil rig is actually the Ekofisk complex, one of the largest in the North Sea. And that photo is actually slightly out of date. It's even bigger now. These are all oil rigs and the oil complexes. They're not static. They don't just get built and stay there. They grow over time. Extra bits get added for various reasons. They're constantly drilling new oil wells. As the main reservoir they're draining the oil out of starts to run out, they'll drill in somewhere else and get some more oil out from somewhere else. But also, some of the smaller platforms here have certain other functions. This is with one of the newer small platforms as part of the complex. It wasn't actually on the previous photograph. This does water injection. There are two reasons for that on this particular complex. Firstly, it's to provide more pressure into the well so that the oil comes up easier. But also on Ekofisk, once it started taking the oil out, the chalk bed that the oil was in started to compress downwards, and the whole complex was sinking. So an additional part function of injecting the water is not just to bring the pressure up for getting the oil out, but stop the oil field actually compressing and collapsing any further. Although it did still need to lift all of the platforms in the complex still needed to be lifted by 6 meters of welding extra bits into the legs some years back. So we have the contestants. So what happened? Well, the events are on the early hours of the 8th of June in 2009. The vessel is waiting out near the complex. They have a 500 meter exclusion zone and they have to wait there until they get permission to go in. And once the platform is ready for them, they'll say, okay, right, let's go through the checklist, make sure everything's okay, and you can enter the 500 meter exclusion zone, and then back up to the rig, wheel up, wind out the hoses and start pumping stuff, depending on whatever job it is they're doing. So at about 4 o'clock in the morning, they got permission to start doing this. Second officer was the only person on the bridge at the time, sitting there minding his own business while twiddling his thumbs. He then contacts the master of the vessel. I took the term master instead of captain because that's in non-military circles, that's generally the preferred term. They're almost interchangeable. So if I say master, that's the correct term, but it means captain, basically. He got summoned out of his bed, as you're the boss in charge when you do the dangerous stuff. And off they went, started moving towards the oil platform. They fairly quickly realised things weren't quite going according to plan. First thing they noticed, that the master noticed, is that he started to try to do a small steering correction and nothing happened. Which worried him a little bit. Said, okay, really fiddled around a bit. Okay, right, okay, I think we might need to slow down. And slow down a little bit. But still didn't seem to have proper steering. Then when it started looking like they were going to run into something, he used the bow thrusters to force the bow around and steer that way. At the same time, he decided to put the ship into reverse thrust to slow down and stop completely, and then sort the problem out. But when he tried that, the ship didn't slow down. So he's got a bit of a problem here. The ship is out of control, he can't put the brakes on, and it's heading towards part of the complex. As well as the complex itself, there are also two supply ships moored up to two of the main platforms. And at this point, having used the bow thrusters to avoid going straight into the main platform, they're basically going between the two, which is fine for avoiding the platforms and the supply ships. But it's a complex, as you saw in the photograph previously. They're connected together by bridges, which pipe various things between the platforms, and they also allow personnel to move around the complex. And he managed to maneuver between the platforms, but he went under the bridge. The ship isn't quite as low as the bridge. So I'll just So it did a certain amount of damage, and I'll show you what damage later. So that was one of the problems. So there was some damage for that, and then they realised that even using the bow thrusters was no longer working as steering. So they can't slow down, they can't even steer. So under they go, damage to the ship under the bridge. Then they're heading towards one of the smaller platforms. It's actually the very small one I showed you on a previous slide, the water injection platform. And basically they hit it. They hit it at 9 knots, which is fairly fast. They did quite a bit of damage to it, including shifting the entire platform 2 meters on the seabed base. So quite a big impact there. And at that point, they just hit the stop button and shut down the propulsion system. Don't know why they didn't do it earlier. It would have helped a lot, as it will become clear. So I'm going to run through these events a second time, saying what actually happened. What I'm wondering now is what the people on the bridge thought was happening. So they shut the engines down, then they drifted away slightly. One of the supply ships by this time had been dispatched to go over and assist them, if necessary, throw a tow line on them, etc. But before they did that, they thought, no, it's okay. They just still didn't know what the problem is, but let's restart the main generators, because the propulsion's all electric. So they've got diesel generators that then drive the electric motors. So they restarted the generators, everything seemed to be okay. Then they started, okay, let's gently back away from the complex under our own power. Well, they did, but then it reversed straight into the supply vessel, just to put the little cherry on top of what was a really bad day. Didn't do an awful lot of damage to either ship, but certainly added to the embarrassment. So, let's go through the meaty bit. What actually happened? Well, that's a plan of the ship's journey through the complex. Started off at the bottom, heading, as you can see, directly towards one of the platforms. This shouldn't happen. Turns out there were two reasons why this was happening. Firstly, the master had inadvertently not turned off the autopilot. Big mistake. But secondly, against all proper good practice, he'd set the waypoint before they even left shore, they're still in the port, he set the waypoints to be the platform itself, rather than something safely to one side, which is what you're supposed to do. And this is why. So, that was the primary mistake, but there are quite a few others. As I said previously, they then started steering using the bow thrusters. But the problem is, he also tried to let's put the brakes on, let's go into reverse thrust. Because of the nature of this ship, it's normal practice, instead of just reversing the propellers, you just turn the pods 380 degrees. Because the nature of them is that they perform slightly better in that direction rather than just reversing the propellers. Which is great if you're in control of the pitch of the pods, but of course the autopilot's in control of that. So when he thought he'd turned them to 180 degrees and gave it full throttle to try and slow down, he was actually giving it full throttle forwards. That meant speed built up. The wash from the bow then meant that there was pretty much a vacuum around the bow thrusters, so they could no longer assist with the steering. So at the point at which the bow thrusters stopped working as well, yep, that's why. So they then carried on trundling through to the water injection platform, which, as already said, they hit it at 9 knots. But there's a lot of reasons why this shouldn't have been able to happen. So we'll just go through some of those. We've already said they set the waypoint incorrectly to begin with. Minor mistake, but mistake nonetheless. So leaving the autopilot switched on, much bigger mistake. Not noticing that when you don't have steering control, mistake. But all of this should have been sorted out before it entered the 500 meter exclusion zone. Both the ship itself and the Ekofisk Complex's radio operator have checklists, both of which include making sure the autopilot is off. One of the things that the ship should also have done is to make sure the dynamic positioning system is working. Normally they would leave it in the dynamic positioning leaving that in control until they get the go-ahead, and then they would go in. But they didn't do that, so they didn't realise they had a problem. And also, there's a checklist that the radio operator of the complex has got, which includes asking the ship, is autopilot turned off, and a few other things. But they were lazy. They marked things off on the checklist without actually doing them. So that's not good. And yeah, as they trundled through, the master didn't actually spot that the autopilot was switched on. He should have done, especially when everything else failed. Also, when you turn the thrust to 180 degrees, there's a handle. It's got a forwards and backwards, and the whole thing rotates. And there's an LED tally ring around the outside. So when he turned it 180 degrees, he really should have noticed that it was not going in the direction he thought it was. But no, he didn't. So he just carried on piling on forwards. There's a few other mistakes they made, but I'll probably mention a few of those later. So, let's look at what sort of damage happened. This is what the ship looked like before the accident. At the top of the bridge, you'll notice there's an awful lot of radar antennas, satellite domes, and similar. Well, not anymore, there isn't. Basically, everything above the bridge got a number one cut. That part of a ship is because it's traditionally got lots of things sticking out of it. It's also the highest part of the ship. It's traditionally known as Monkey Island. And basically everything got wiped out. They're lucky that the bridge wasn't just a little bit lower, or else it would have hit the crane you can see on the back of the ship, which is very firmly attached to the structure of the ship and would have caused a lot more damage to the cross bridge and probably the ship itself. As for the front of the ship, well, it's 4 meters shorter. Really not good. That water injection platform that I showed you previously, yes, there you go. That's what it should have looked like. That didn't fare too good either. You'll notice a few of those cross pieces have gaps at the end where they got broken off the rest of the rig. Or, sorry, platform. as I mentioned previously, the whole thing was shifted 4 meters on its seabed base. For various reasons, this injection platform is due to be gradually decommissioned over the next 2 years. It didn't happen. They wrote it off. It was irreparable, and they then had to. Then the whole complex was shut down until this and certain other things were repaired. So, yeah, they made a lot of mistakes. You think, well, why did these people do this? Well, part of the problem is it was the second officer's first trip. He joined the ship for the first time 2 days beforehand, and he hadn't been properly trained. That was made exactly what was missing from his training wasn't mentioned in the report, but the fact that he was not properly trained was. Another aspect was mentioned was poor bridge culture. The master was in charge and you don't ask questions. A more experienced second officer and better culture than the second officer perhaps would have noticed what was going on and said, this is not right. As I've already mentioned, the checklists weren't completed. Or rather they were, because the checks themselves hadn't been done. Very bad practice indeed. And of course they didn't test the dynamic position system before entering the exclusion zone, in which that would have revealed, of course, that they had a problem. The Ekofisk platform itself, well, they also skipped items on the checklist. Also, as the vessel gained speed, it was exceeding the speed limit for the 500 meter zone. They didn't notice or didn't consider it a problem. And they also didn't notice that its course was directly towards one of the main platforms. Again, nothing was said. So, not good, a lot of damage. Nobody hurt though, and fortunately, No hydrocarbons escaped. So it's just an insurance job. As I said in the description of this, a big insurance job. Well, how big? $700 million is a lot of money, even in the oil industry. The ship surprisingly was actually repaired and put back into service. But as to what contributed lots to that $700 million, the production had shut down for pretty much entirely for about 2 months. That would have been a lot of it. But there were a few other areas needed to deal with as well. So the other thing is, how much worse could it have actually been? Well, quite a lot worse. If it had hit one of the main platforms, obviously much greater chance of release of gas or oil, and obviously human costs as well, potentially. The most likely bad scenario is if they were a little bit higher and done more damage to the crossbridge. There's an 8-inch high pressure gas pipe through there, oil goes through it as well. That lot would all have been released, almost certainly found an ignition source on the ship, and there would have been a big fireball and probably a lot of loss of life. Also, a temporary feature of the complex at the time was a jack-up accommodation platform. It was originally a mobile drilling rig, but it had been converted to purely accommodation. That could have had up to 200 people on it. And because they're mobile, they're not really designed to take the very worst of weather, because the assumption is that if it's really bad winter weather, you just don't bring them up to the platform. If it hit that, good chance one of the three legs could have buckled. And, well, loss of life, very large indeed if that happens. So, not good. So there's quite a few things that people should have learned from this, and is it a good example of what's known in health and safety circles as the Swiss cheese model of health and safety? Multiple layers of cheese, all little holes in. It's all fine until they all happen to line up at the same time, through things go, and it all goes horribly wrong, exactly as happened in this case. And of course, checklists can be annoying, but again, you don't do the checklists, you cut corners, this is the sort of thing that can happen. And of course, the final point is, just because you get away with not doing something and obeying all the rules does not mean it's okay. Nobody was killed at this time, nobody was even badly hurt. I suspect a few people got bruised when the ship suddenly stopped from 9 knots to zero instantaneously, but they weren't recorded as injuries. But yeah. Skipping something, it's perfectly safe. There's other things that will catch it. Not this time. So, yeah, it could have been a whole lot worse. A lot of lives lost. But because there were no lives lost, no pollution, it didn't make mainstream news at all. Not because information was suppressed, but, of course, if it happens offshore, most people don't even know about it. In addition to that, people in the industry tend not to like talking about these sorts of things. They're not necessarily going to get fired if they do, but they always worry about, well, maybe I won't get offered the job next time if I'm the one that spilt the beans. Well, this happened 13 years ago, so I think I'm pretty safe ground there. And I wasn't actually present on site either. I just do maintenance on the ship quite a lot of the time. On the propulsion system, funnily enough. So when the rumour came back through the industry when it happened that it hit the platform due to a power failure and one of our people had been on board a few weeks beforehand, we were getting a bit worried. However, as you now know, it was human failure all the way down the line, as is so often the case. And I think that about sums it up, really. We're not doing Q&A this at the EMF camp this year, but if you want to catch me in the bar afterwards, ask me questions about this or anything else relating to the industry for that matter, feel free. Just wait till I've got a pint in my hand first. Okay, that's it. Thank you.